is the End User, episode Gross for Tuesday, August 27th. Hilariously anachronistic. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Moore.
And we took another week off last week. This time it was my fault. I was up traveling in Wisconsin, the land of beer and cheese. So I had a good time up there.
Yeah, sounds great. Did you have any cheese beer?
No cheese beer. Although I think you've just invented something wonderful, and you should start that business immediately.
Right. Well, I've had beer cheese. That's quite good.
Yeah, or there's got to be some kind of like beer cheese soup or something.
Oh, there absolutely is.
Yeah, so I don't know. We'll have to get on that.
All right, but moving on. Back from the doldrums. And, well, you've missed quite a bit. The CEO of Microsoft, Steve Ballmer, announced he's going to retire within a year.
Right, and this is crazy. Steve Ballmer has been the CEO of Microsoft for something like 13 years at this point.
Yeah, since 2000, and he's been a Microsoft employee since 1980.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was Bill Gates' roommate at Harvard, so he's been around the business a very long time, and I'm not surprised to see him step down at this point in time. I think they must have had some kind of mutual agreement where he says, you know, look, I'm getting old in this job here, and I'd like to retire. And they said, okay. You know, they didn't really object too much about it because a lot of people have been calling for his head in the first place.
Well, still, it's the end of an era, but Microsoft is a big company, and, you know, Ballmer is kind of a money man. You know, he's not the...
Yeah, he's a businessman.
...the visionary force like Steve Jobs or somebody. But he's been a great CEO. He had 16% growth every year that he was CEO, which is very, very impressive. And, yeah, he's getting old, so sure. If he wants to retire, he can.
Yeah, that's kind of my take on it. I have seen a lot of hyperbole around the interwebs about this event because, you know, I think a lot of people think that since he's not a product guy, that he has missed a ton of technology trends, including, you know, the smartphone and all kinds of technology trends. But if you're right, if you look at the business of Microsoft, it's pretty much it's got some healthy growth. He kept the company on track, and you know it's not the most impressive growth or anything. But I think we can say that he did a pretty good job, despite a lot of the kind of vitriol I see out on the internet about it.
Yeah, it's worth reiterating that he is not a product guy. He sort of let the creative heads of the departments do their own thing, and then he sort of picked and chose which to nurture and which to drop.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. And he's the business side of things. You know, he never was going to be somebody like Steve Jobs. That just wasn't what he was there for. So it's very interesting to see him step down. What's perhaps more interesting than him retiring is what's next. Who's the next CEO? You know, we don't really know. And there's a lot of fortune teller blog posting going around. And we'll see who gets the fortune correct.
Elon Musk. That's my money's on Elon Musk.
I think it's going to be Iron Man, personally.
Well, Elon Musk is Iron Man.
Right, no, but I mean actually Iron Man. There's going to be a man in a suit made of iron with a...
Oh, and we just won't know his identity.
Yeah, he'll be secret.
Right, he'll just fly around shooting Windows lasers everywhere.
Yes, exactly right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Windows IntelliLaser Explorer 9000.
11,000, but yeah, close enough.
Sorry, it's old technology. I don't know the latest thing.
Oh, yeah. That's
okay,
the latest.
But speaking of Windows and the latest thing, we have news this week that Windows 8.1, remember we talked about this before? What was it called? Windows Blue? That was the code name?
Yep. Yes, indeed. That was the code
name. Now, I thought I remembered it was going to maybe cost like $10 or $15, but they've announced that it's going to be free for Windows 8 owners.
Yes, it's free for anybody who has Windows 8, and it really is an amalgamation of updates that is what Windows 8 should have been in the first place, is kind of right. The way I'm looking at it.
Well, your copy of Windows 8 will become what it should have been on October 17th.
Right, and there's some question about why the wait. It's baked. It's done. They've released it to manufacturing, and why the wait? For people who have their own version of Windows and don't bother with manufacturers, I'm not sure why wait from now until October to release this thing, but that's the way it's going to be.
Yep.
So I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be a huge improvement in usability of Windows 8. No matter what you may or may not think of Windows 8 in its current form, it's for pretty much all persuasions, it will be a pretty large update in the functionality of Windows 8. So I'm pretty excited to get that down the line.
I bet they're waiting because they have to test it with all of the different devices.
Well, right. So I understand why the manufacturer might choose to delay it until October. But for people who have a Windows 8 copy on a disk, they don't get that kind of luxury anyway. So I don't know. That's a narrow definition anyway. So,
all right. Well, I don't know the real reason. Nobody knows the real reason why it's going to take two more months.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just because that's how it's been in the past, and that kind of just continues. So we've got this two-month lag in a way that isn't necessarily the same across some more frequently updated applications, like the actual applications that are on Windows 8 get updated regularly here. So it's kind of an artificial limitation, but I guess that's how it's been in the past, so that's how it's going to be now. And I do kind of wonder if that'll change at some point in the future.
Yeah, it might. I don't know. It wouldn't be worth it for me to speculate.
Yep,
but
so,
in other news about real products that are available now, TiVo has announced its fifth generation of TiVo DVRs, and they're calling this one Romeo, as in R-O-A-M-I-O. And their idea is to make your content available basically wherever you want it. And that's supposed to mean being able to stream content from the TiVo over the internet to any device. But right now, it's only over your local network and only to iPhones.
Right. So, you know, that's the first thing they accomplished, and they're releasing it, I guess, right? I'm sure they have plans to roll it to some of the other platforms.
Yeah, and also to enable internet functionality. So they're saying that's all going to come by the end of the year.
So I know that the DVR market for cable is actually a really huge one, and it really doesn't get enough of a talking with most of the tech news coverage. And I feel like this kind of went under my radar a little bit, just because it's I feel like TiVo is like the old guard in TV watching.
And yeah, sure, absolutely.
This is them kind of catching up to a lot of that kind of internet functionality that had previously been a little lacking. So I'm excited to see them try something here.
Right. This basically puts them, well, if they get all of these features enabled, it puts them pretty much on parity. All right, so they've released three models of this Rovio TiVo. You've got the regular Romeo, the Romeo Plus, and the Romeo Pro. The high-end one can record six shows at once and up to 450 hours of HD recording. And they all basically have streaming to Wi-Fi. Oh, I guess except for the regular Romeo, which requires an additional TiVo Stream adapter.
And the one of the interesting details here for me, since I don't have cable, is the base model is compatible with over the air, it says here. So that could be quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really recommend it to anybody who was only using it for over-the-air TV. But I guess if you really like it.
Yeah, I don't know. I could see some, I mean, it's an internet-connected device that has a bunch of internet content, as well as the local over-the-air channels. That could be kind of compelling. That's kind of what I'm after. So anyway, I think I'm jumping ahead of myself there. We'll have to see what that actually means.
Yeah, well, it probably works decently, but it might be a while before somebody else tests it for you, Chris.
Yeah, that's true. It's not exactly the largest chunk of the TV watching market.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, those three models of Romeo are $200, $400, and $600. And you still have to pay the monthly fee to access TiVo's servers.
See, that's what's always killed me for TiVo, is that monthly hit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a premium service.
Yeah, I guess it is, but there's some sweet spot for me, and maybe I'm crazy, where I'd like to be able to DVR over-the-air content for free and then have internet content on top of that.
Isn't that why you have a Windows Media Center, Chris?
Yes, that's true. That's true. Although, at this point, Windows Media Center is not getting updated so much, and it's really starting to fade into the sunset, as it were. So, it still works very well. That part is fine. But I could see somebody coming into that market and make a device that makes sense for that specific scenario and being really, really popular in that particular niche. And I think that niche is actually a pretty large one.
Well, I think Roku and Boxy are making steps into that, of having a DVR service built into their devices.
Yeah, that's right. So now it's shut down now, but Boxy had some cloud DVR functionality a while back there.
Right. And then for over-the-air stuff, there are things like Aereo, which are only available in two cities so far, but they've cleared most of their legal hurdles, so they should be expanding soon.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm still looking in that niche to see who can provide that kind of service for me. And maybe I'm just a crazy loner, and I'm the only person that actually wants to do that. And everybody else who is more sane just gets cable like the rest of humanity.
Well, it's very expensive to have cable, especially because they also charge you a nominal monthly fee to have DVR service.
Yes, or often at least.
I've never met anybody who got HD and DVR for free.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, I'm excited to see what TiVo can do here. Can they revitalize their brand in some way? I am excited to see what happens with this.
Well, Chris, if they can convert you, then I would be very much more optimistic about their future as a company.
Yeah, that's true. Well, so we'll see what happens with them.
But even still, they have a big market, and a lot of people,
yes,
they've been using TiVo for 15 years at this point, and they're comfortable with it, and they're advancing their technology, and they're making a name for themselves.
And I bet you they still have that little clicky noise when you hit the button. That would, like, if I were somebody who had a TiVo and I lost that little clicky noise, I would feel like a part of me died. It would be very distressing.
Yeah, I saw somebody make the noise with their mouth one time.
Yeah, so they just had a regular cable DVR and they just made the noise with their mouth just to feel good about it.
Well, yeah.
All right, well, that'll do it for our top news this week. Should we get into our afterburners? You got your seatbelt on?
Sure, let me put my seatbelt on. Okay, I'm ready to go.
So Google has launched a new YouTube makeover for the Android application. And we've seen some Chromecast action recently here, but they're also redoing the entire application to kind of get it up to date and add a few new features. So if you're an Android person, go get the new YouTube app. It should start rolling out sometime soon. There's also an APK file that you can install if you're really on the bleeding edge with Android. So
and
go have
as a
look.
Of fact,
cool.
As a matter of fact, they've already updated the iOS app to include almost all of the same new features.
Neat.
You have picture-in-picture app capability, and you can search for one video while you're watching another.
And more on this later, but Windows Phone is a little left out of the YouTube app party. So we'll talk about that a bit later, though.
Indeed, we will.
So Google and Waze are now sharing their map data. So the data that gets pumped into Waze, the phone application, will start to influence the way Google Maps behaves. So that's pretty cool. Google acquired them for $1 billion in this June. So that's interesting to see them start to roll that stuff out.
Google Maps has always had better construction reporting when it comes to traffic. I mean, Waze is really the majority of the value of Waze to Google is their traffic reporting. So Waze has much better accident reporting, and Maps had much better construction reporting when it comes to traffic. And now you have the best of both worlds.
So, yeah, put them together, and a good thing is definitely the result of that.
Right.
So LG is starting to show off its new 2560 by 1440 display for smartphones. It's a 5.5-inch screen. It's 538 pixels per inch. So I know it was either the last podcast or the one before it where we were saying, isn't 1080p for phones over? Isn't that's the end of phone screens, right? No, not the end of phone screens. This is the next thing.
Right. I wonder how high we will go. I mean, it would be kind of ridiculous to put this in a phone, but it sure does look pretty, sort of. I mean, they only have a picture of a test unit on a black slab, but I'm sure it looks great in person. Yeah. Another thing that will look great in person is Samsung's new 55-inch OLED TV. It's curved. It's incredibly thin. It's incredibly bright. We talked about it before, and it was expected to come out for $10,000 in the United States, but they have lowered the price to $9,000. Still very much an early adopter product. Probably wouldn't recommend it to most people looking for a new TV. Go ahead and get yourself a new 4K TV. Get yourself some extreme sharpness, which is ironically the branding for their new 1080p OLED TV. And that beats LG, which has had a 55-inch OLED TV on the market since July, but is still selling for $15,000.
And Facebook is unveiling a new feature that allows you to have shared photo albums. So this is pretty neat. I don't have it in my Facebook yet, so I haven't got to play around with this. But basically, you can, you know, say this is my album. There's some kind of event or trip you've taken, and other people can collectively upload images to that album. So that's pretty neat.
Yeah, Apple is introducing this as part of their photo stream albums in iOS 7. So Facebook has beaten them to the punch, and I think this could be a really successful feature if it catches on.
Yeah, definitely. I'd like to see it once it gets rolled out.
Right. Well, Sony has finally announced the release date for the PlayStation 4. It will be available in North America on November 15th and Europe on November 29th. No announcements for the rest of the world thus far, but safe to say it'll probably be available in limited quantities worldwide by Christmas 2013.
And it's your move, Microsoft.
If you are itching for a PlayStation right now, you can go ahead and grab a fully flash-based PS3 Slim with 12 gigabytes of flash-based storage for only $200.
Feedly Pro, that we've talked about before in the past, is launching to everyone instead of just the selected beta group that was around there. And for $5 a month, you get the ability to search your feeds. You get some Evernote integration and some Pocket integration. And you also get some premium customer support as well. And they have rolled out HTTPS for everyone, which is good to see. That should be a feature of the free application because security is important to everyone. So I'm glad to see that they made that a free addition.
Yeah, this is great. I'm considering it. I am definitely sticking with Feedly as a Google Reader replacement for the time being, but I'll tell you, I really miss Google Reader.
Yeah, I still kind of miss it, even with all of the options that we've talked about, and none of them are quite the same as Google Reader was in its heyday. All right, so let's turn off the afterburners. Mr. Maher, you can undo your seatbelt if you are so inclined.
Okay, seatbelt undone.
Cool. We can get into our the end user stories of the week.
Let's do it.
So this is kind of cool. Pandora has announced that they're going to do away with the 40-hour mobile listening cap, and that's going to happen on September 1st. So by the time a lot of people are listening to this, this may already have happened.
Yeah, this makes sense to me. Well, I won't notice it, I don't think, because I have never run into that cap. I use Pandora very sporadically.
I haven't either. I use Pandora quite a bit. And I've never run up against the 40-hour cap, though. So it kind of makes sense because they've implemented other ways of limiting your usage. So, you know, this cap was in place before they had implemented the track skipping cap, I guess, is what you'd call it.
Right.
Where you can only skip so many tracks per hour, and that's intended to limit your usage. And thus, the whole point of this, which is kind of the ridiculous part, is that they need to limit your usage of the application because they have to pay expensive licensing fees. So if you're not sitting there actually listening to the music, then they kind of don't want to pay for the license to play that song in the first place. So they have to do this weird dance where they want to get as many users as possible listening, but they don't want them to kind of abuse the amount of tracks that they have to pay for. So it's kind of a weird model, and I'd have to imagine that sometime in the future, when the music industry gets a little hip, that will be a little more friction-free. But for the moment, they've worked out a pretty good way of doing things with the limitation of track skipping and removing this 40-hour cap.
Chris, I would bet that they did some market product testing and found out that they were losing basically no paid customers based on that 40-hour cap. So the only strong reason that I can see for the 40-hour cap was to get people to pay to circumvent that limit. And I think people are willing to pay to get rid of the ads. But as far as that limit goes, nobody was willing to pay to get more listening.
Sure. That kind of makes sense to me, too. So, yeah, I think this is how it should have been in the first place. So I'm kind of glad to see it happen like this.
Right. But it's also worth pointing out that they may be responding to marketplace competition. iTunes Radio is coming out soon. Google Play has just launched their radio service. And, there are a bunch more on the market now than when Pandora started.
Yeah, the other one, which is a kind of legally gray, if I remember right, is Groove Shark. Use that one quite a bit.
Right, or Spotify.
Spotify is a great option, yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah, there's a lot more competitors out there. You're certainly right.
Yeah. Yeah, my father prefers Pandora and pays for it, and my sister prefers Spotify and pays for it. And I am really looking forward to iTunes Radio.
And then the kids these days just use YouTube. Or at least that's the word on the street. I'm not sure how true that actually is.
Yeah, you've been talking with kids on the street, Chris?
Yes.
Is that what you've been doing?
That's what I've been told. I've been interviewing I've been interviewing random children on the street for quite some time now, and they all listen to Vivo content on YouTube.
I would rethink that strategy, Chris. I would rethink it. It's a gross strategy. I'm not sure about it.
Well, speaking of YouTube, we've got a little more YouTube drama. We mentioned the updated iOS and Android applications, and Windows Phone gets no such love, like I mentioned. And so I'll start from the beginning. So originally, Microsoft had some dispute with Google about how to implement their YouTube app, and what they ended up doing was just including a link to their HTML5 application and just have like a browser open for the YouTube application, and that was all they would do. So at some point, I think Microsoft got a little fed up with it, and they released a kind of ridiculous YouTube application, and it allowed for downloading of YouTube videos and that kind of thing, which is clearly an egregious violation of the YouTube terms of service. So clearly that wasn't going to stand, but I think that was kind of their way of putting their foot in the door to open the issue of the Windows Phone YouTube app only being a little HTML5 web page. So they went into negotiations with Google, and then on the other end we got a brand new Windows Phone YouTube app that removed the feature for downloading and some of the other really bad breaches of the terms of service. And you know, life was good for a little while there. And that update was released on August 13th, and I got to use it for a while, and it worked pretty well. It was a great app. And then Google came back around and blocked the application specifically by revoking Microsoft's developer API key. So they've cited that the application is still in violation of their terms of service, and they're not allowing it to be out on Windows Phone. So currently what is happening is there is a broken YouTube app from Microsoft in the Windows Phone store that Google is blocking.
It's really a shame. Google seems to me to be acting a little bit dense when it comes to platform support for YouTube. Somebody was just asking me earlier this week, they have a Roku, and they said, "Hey, Taylor, how do I find YouTube on Roku?" And I said, "There's still no YouTube for Roku." And they said, "I thought that was like 2 years ago." I said, "Well, yeah, it's still the case."
That seems ridiculous on the face of it, doesn't it? Why? Don't they want
exactly.
to...
Exactly. Google wants YouTube to be the ubiquitous video service. I mean, they have competitors. There are a lot out there.
Yeah, I mean, they're... And I would say that they're being completely anti-competitive, and you know, they want Android to succeed, as if Android wasn't succeeding already. But, you know, they updated the iOS app, which is a native application for YouTube.
They're picking and choosing in an odd way.
Even that kind of falls apart.
Right.
So I'm not quite sure what to think of this. But what I do know is that it's bad for Windows Phone users. And, again, I always have to approach Windows Phone with the caveat that I realize that I am of a very small pool of Windows Phone users when you talk about the smartphone market. But, you know, I don't understand why this is important to them. I can't imagine that blocking YouTube access to a fledgling platform that has 4% market share could be worth all of this time and effort for them. So it's a little baffling to me, and it's hurting consumers, and it's hurting my attitude toward Google in some way, and I'm sure other people of the small pool of Windows Phone users also feel that same way.
There's just some YouTube developer who's got a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, it's actually just one guy
in a
room somewhere filing takedown notices or whatever.
Oh, well, the takedown notices come from everywhere.
Well, so anyway, that's a little bit disappointing to me, so we'll have to see what happens, how this shakes out. But currently, you open the YouTube app, and you get an error message that says something went wrong, but we're not quite sure what.
It's disappointing to me, too, Chris, on sympathetic and philosophy levels. But I'm currently enjoying the YouTube app for my iPad.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll figure it out, and we'll get it fixed eventually. But, I wanted to watch some YouTube videos in the meantime. And I can go to the mobile website, and that's okay for now. But they've got to fix that.
Right.
All right, well, you've got one of the most intriguing headlines I think we've seen all year from your green techs. It's fungus and bacteria play game theory to make biofuels. What's going on?
All right,
here?
I'm going to get a little
Explain
nerdy
yourself.
Here. I'll try to go through it as fast as possible. We've been trying to produce biofuels, that is, to make alcohol usable for combustion engines in the United States and indeed all around the world. For years, decades, really. Other economies have done it successfully. Brazil, for example, pretty much every car in Brazil runs on methanol. In NASCAR and Formula One, they've switched entirely to biofuels for most race classes. And indeed, you've probably seen some flex fuel vehicles or some flex fuel pumps if you drive around or go to gas stations or anything. But it's inherently just less efficient than digging gasoline out of the ground. The advantage, though, is that if we find a more efficient way to do it, then that becomes more efficient than drilling for oil, because that gets less and less efficient every year as we exhaust our reserves. So lots of research goes into making biofuels. Now, the easiest stuff to turn into energy is the stuff that we already eat for energy. But then you have a problem. You have energy demands competing with food demands. So if we can figure out how to make biofuel out of something that we wouldn't otherwise eat or use, then that would be much better. Now, cellulose is a very common component of most plants that humans and any mammals cannot digest. So it's a prime target. We've already developed fungus that can break down cellulose and turn it into sugars, which we can then convert to alcohol using another fungus, yeast. But the first fungus that turns cellulose into sugar, it likes to eat that sugar. That's why it breaks it down. So if we want to use that fungus efficiently, we've got to grab the sugar from the fungus before it breaks, before it eats the sugar that it's broken down from cellulose. The way we do that is by turning it into alcohol as fast as possible using genetically manipulated strains of E. coli, which we use for turning lots of base substances into lots of useful substances, depending on the strain of E. coli. So they've been playing with this idea for a while, trying to get a fungus and an E. coli bacteria to work together to make a really efficient product of biofuel. And that's where game theory comes into play. See, the fungus is creating the sugars out of cellulose, but it wants that sugar, and the E. coli is stealing the sugar. So you have these two competing needs between these organisms, and the game theory that you need to figure out is, in order to maximize the amount of biofuel that you get out of this combination, you need to figure out how much E. coli do I need and how much fungus do I need. And they've been messing around with it for a while, and they finally got a combination, which is right around 1-to-1, actually, to make 50 to 60% of the available energy in the cellulose into usable biofuel isobutanol. And they may, in fact, find other fungi, other strains of bacteria that can increase that, but that's 60% is pretty good when you basically have two microorganisms doing all of the work for you on plant matter that would otherwise be trash. So, Chris, did you follow that?
I think I got most of it.
Okay.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty complicated, right? But really...
It is really complicated, yeah, but I just thought it was the coolest thing because you're taking green tech, you're taking the forefront of biological research, and you are taking advanced macroeconomic theory and math in the form of game theory.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So,
but the end result is scientists have figured out a way to relatively efficiently convert unusable plant matter into biofuel.
Right, into biofuel. So this is it's like the cherry on top. This is something that is previously just unused and discarded or something. Is that right?
Right. Well, they've been working on turning cellulose into biofuel for almost as long as they've been making biofuel. And this cool. This is the best way they've found so far. This is the first way that on a number of different levels looks to be economically viable.
Cool. Neat.
And even better, they managed to make isobutanol instead of ethanol or methanol, and isobutanol is a better biofuel alcohol. It's more energy dense.
Cool. All right. Well, with that, let's get into our tip of the week. As usual, you have us covered. What you got for us?
This was a fun little one that came off of
Lifehacker's
reader tips that they do a couple of times a week, and it has to do with your mouse. Now, if you have one of those mice that has a forward and back button on the side, if you use that a lot, that's great. But I asked you about it before the show, Chris, and you said you don't use yours. You don't even have it mapped to anything right now.
No, I don't.
And they had a tip from a reader who said, I was getting repetitive stress injury from using copy and paste shortcuts on my keyboard so often, so I just remapped it to the forward and back buttons on my mouse. Now, depending on whether you have Windows or Mac or Linux, there are a bunch of tools that let you do this. they're not very hard to find. I don't actually have one of those mice, so I didn't bother to look it up. But the Lifehacker article has a link to a few of them. And that's it. Just remap your mouse forward and back buttons to copy and paste.
Yeah, it's pretty clever.
I might remap some of the functions in my Magic Mouse to do that.
Yeah, you could do the same thing. So, like, how often do you use Zoom on your Magic Mouse? Or some of the other gestures?
Well, there's third-party software specifically for the Magic Mouse that would allow me to enable some complicated gestures. So.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a pretty neat one, I thought. You know, and I'm also keyboard-driven, so I don't know if I'll get repetitive stress injury from that, but it's a pretty neat idea. Those are two very useful functions that are good to have at your fingertips, and that seems like a good place to put them. And like you said, I never use the back and forward buttons. They're just not often used is all.
Right. Well, anyway, that's it. It's a pretty simple tip. And for my app pick this week, it's also something I have no personal experience in. It is a Windows app called Full Throttle. Now, this is for Windows laptop owners or people who otherwise have reason to be miserly with their power. What it does is it alters your power management profile. So if you're running on battery power, for example, it will let you change the profile and reallocate more system resources towards certain programs. So if you're using the battery and you want to conserve your battery as much as possible, but you're rendering a video or something on one particular program and you need to have that going full power, you can use this to kick that one program up while still saving power on everything else. So I thought that was pretty cool. Now, if you use a Mac, you can just wait for Mavericks to come out because Mavericks does that automatically.
And, Windows does something very similar to that, and you can set power plans to be pretty customized. And I don't think you can do it per application, which is what this little app enables you to do. But the power options for Windows are also pretty good.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the power options are great, but if you have a lot of programs running and you want to conserve energy with most of them and you need something to have access to the full unadulterated firepower of your computer, then you can use this to do that.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, let's get into our last story of the week, our kicker. What do we have here? This is neat.
This is a TV show, a half-hour TV show from 1997 that explains the hilariously simple and old-fashioned internet that we had at the time. And I really can't even do it justice. It's a half-hour TV show, so the video is 27 minutes long. You don't have to watch the whole thing, but just pretty much I just scanned through it a couple of different times and every single moment that I clicked was hilariously anachronistic.
It was filled with hilarity. Yeah, it is pretty good. I'm trying to figure out what operating system they're using there. Well, anyway, you'll have to follow through in the show links to pick out some clips of that particular link. We'll have a link in the show notes for everyone listening who wants to go check out this video. And you do realize that in the future, perhaps even this podcast will seem equally as ridiculous. That's what it makes me think of.
I do realize that as the end user's futurist prime, I know exactly
know.
How ridiculous it will look, yes.
Yeah, you're saying you're worrying about batteries. Our laptops don't even have batteries in the future. They eat corn.
Well, hopefully they eat corn using a symbiotic game theory hybrid fungus bacteria.
Absolutely. No, I just like the idea of like instead of a battery, there's like a corn on the cob in the back of the laptop. maybe that's...
That seems less efficient somehow.
Yeah, it doesn't seem too great, actually. I take it back.
And then that... We run into the whole problem of, like, there's corn for people and then there's corn for computers.
Yeah, there's computer corn.
Right. We don't want the computers competing with us for resources because that's Skynet. That's how the Terminator happens.
Right. Right. Definitely want to avoid Skynet, that's for sure. All right, well, on that note, I think it's time to get out of here. So if somebody wanted to contact you about something, perhaps corn-eating computers, how would they leave feedback about corn-eating computers to you?
Oh, they should definitely make a Vine and tag me on it, and then we'll do a collab Vine. It'll be great.
That works. And yeah. Do they need your Vine username then?
Oh, my Vine username is the same as my Twitter username. It's TaylorPhone.
Cool. So I guess you can also get at him on Twitter as well. And if you want to get at me, I am @ChrisHaleBarnes on Twitter. That's probably the best way to get at me. All right, so that'll do it for this week. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information in the show notes at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a handful of other podcasts. You can have a look at Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and the home automation podcast, Home On. You can send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. You can ping us at the usernames we just mentioned, or together we are @theenduser. Join us live in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.